Well, Dick always says, well, and I'm kind of mimicking him when I do that. Well, we've now got two-thirds of the 49th Fighter Group moved across the mountain to the north side of New Guinea, and this was a tremendous advantage for us. It meant that we could follow the enemy up and down the coast, though there wasn't much down the coast involved, without regard to the weather, pretty much. Certainly we didn't give a damn what the weather did over the Owen Stanley Mountains, which were the big barrier to getting across. I ought also to say about now that the 5th Air Force, which even in its heyday, I suppose, was relative to Europe, pretty small potatoes. But nevertheless, about the time I got to Australia, and I've described a lot of that situation already, somebody made some complaint back in the States that they, whoever they was, wouldn't give General MacArthur any airplanes. And this got into the press, and a big to-do was made over it. Enough to-do that even I knew about it, 3,000 miles away. And somebody back there said, well, nobody said General MacArthur couldn't have airplanes. He didn't ask for them, or something silly like that. Anyway, the point of all this is that beginning at that time, and I have to lay it on General Kenny, who was the commanding general of the 5th Air Force, who was a dynamo, if there ever was one. Put on some pressure, no doubt. Anyway, we started getting airplanes. And started getting airplanes in some quantity. Those who already had airplanes, but not enough, like the 49th Fighter Group, the 35th Fighter Group, the 8th Fighter Group, got new airplanes to replace the ones they had used up. The bomber people started getting airplanes to replace those they had used up. And we started getting increased numbers of bombers, particularly B-25s. I believe this is a good time to talk about some of these things a little bit. The bombers we had had in the past were B-17s, and I already told you they had worked their way down laboriously and bloodily from island to island, from the Philippines to Australia. And those airplanes, I'm not going to say they had had it, but they had seen a hell of a lot of service. About this time, I don't know when exactly, the decision was apparently made to pull all the B-17s out of the Southwest Pacific and to replace them with B-24s. Now, there was a good reason for this. In the first place, the 8th Air Force in England needed B-17s desperately, and it needed them in huge numbers. The B-17 was better suited to the war in Europe because it was more heavily armored, and I don't mean it had more guns, I mean that it could take battle damage far better than the B-24. And that's what they were getting over there, was enormous amounts of battle damage. On the other hand, the B-24 had a longer range than the B-17, and that suited the Pacific area well, because most of the flying in the Pacific, as far as bombers were concerned, was over water flying, and range was a big consideration. The B-24 would carry a somewhat heavier bomb load, and the enemy opposition in the Pacific was not such as to necessarily require a bomber that could take huge amounts of battle damage. In a theater as small as ours, it was just not sensible to have two types of heavy bombers, because that meant supplies and spare parts and all that for two different types of airplanes. And of course, supplies for thing like that would amount to warehouse after warehouse full of stuff, parts. And it wasn't a smart thing to try to use two types of heavy bombers in an area that small. So they took the B-17s out altogether. And what happened to them, I don't know, but they disappeared. And their place was taken by B-24s. The first group that I know of B-24s to appear in New Guinea came from Hawaii. And I forget what bomb group that was. But I happened to be in either Townsville or Brisbane, I forget which, but it was probably Townsville, when the first group of B-24s arrived. And they came in the late afternoon. They had assumed a string formation, which meant that they were not in normal formation. It was just one and behind the other, behind the other, behind the other, behind the other. And they came in about a minute apart. I don't know how many there were, probably 50, 60, or 70 of them. Maybe that doesn't sound like a lot of airplanes to you. But they came in there one by one and landed, and another, and another, and another. And you could see them in the distance as far as the eye could see up the coast, coming in there, just a long string of airplanes. And of course, in those days, and to us, these were four-engine bombers. They were big airplanes in those days. And they landed, 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 and this went on and on. And they parked them in all the ready parking places, and then they started lining them up wingtip to wingtip along the sides of the runway. And they came, and they came, and they came. I have never seen such a sight. I'll tell you, the only time I've ever seen anything comparable, and that was only a few years ago. It was probably about 1978 or long in there, who knows. I had gone to Santa Monica to spend Christmas with Jack and Eleanor. And I flew back on Christmas night or some such time, and because of weather, the San Francisco airport was closed, and so the flight I was on was rerouted to San Jose. San Jose is a perfectly good-sized airport and all that, but it couldn't be called big. But there's nothing inadequate about it. and we landed. And then these airplanes started coming in, all diverted from SFO. And there was everybody you ever heard of in your life. American, TWA, PSA, United, Lufthansa, Pan American, Scandinavian Airlines, Air France, British Airways, I don't know what else. They just came and they came and they came and they again, just like before, they lined up nose to tail on the runways and beside the runways and on the taxiways. I never saw some, of course, these were all jets and a very different matter. But it's the only other time I've ever seen such a conglomeration of big aircraft just pouring in one after the other after the other after the other. One of the most impressive sights I ever saw. So the 5th Air Force started getting B-24s instead of B-17s. And they were getting B-25s in huge quantities. Now, we'd had a few miscellaneous aircraft in the past as far as two-engine bombers were concerned. We'd had some B-26s. Where they came from, God only knows, but there were some. A handful. And as a footnote, I wish to say that we hated to escort B-26s because they were fast. They were faster than we were, and they were very hard to keep up with them, let alone give them any protection. There were some A-20s, which was a Douglas attack plane, and an airplane that I always terribly wanted to fly and never did. They didn't do very well, and they were phased out during the war, and they got shot down in large numbers. I don't know why exactly. I guess they were too slow or something, but it sure was a nice airplane. And there was only one pilot, and there were other crew members, but there was only one pilot, and it was nice. Anyway, they disappeared. And everything really was taken over pretty much by B-25s as far as medium bombers were concerned. And these airplanes began being supplied to the 5th Air Force in larger and larger numbers. And I already said that the 5th Air Force, compared to people like the 8th, or the 12th, or the 9th, were pretty small potatoes. But the fact remains that for us, we were beginning to get an awful lot of airplanes. General Kenny was a good enough man to eventually command the respect of General MacArthur, which was no small achievement, I'll tell you that. General MacArthur was generally considered to be opposed to the Air Corps, and he didn't care for him, and he didn't believe in him, and he had no use for him. At least that's the way it was always represented to us. And but before General Kenny was done with him, MacArthur considered him one of his right-hand men, which indeed he was. More than that, as a matter of fact, without the Air Force, General MacArthur would have had it. General Kenny had a philosophy that you never let the enemy alone. And there were lots of times when General Kenny didn't have very many airplanes to play with on a given day. But it didn't matter. If he had 50 airplanes, he would send out 50. If he had two, he'd send out two, but he never let the enemy alone. He harassed them constantly. As long as the weather permitted, he would send somebody out there to bomb them and strafe them and make life miserable for them, but he never let up on them. Never. That's the kind of man he was. As for General MacArthur, I saw him one time One time only. I was in Brisbane, down to ferry back a new airplane. And was waiting around with nothing to do, and I was down near the place which was his headquarters, which was a hotel. And it happened, his car drove up, a big Cadillac or some damn thing. General Kenny, by the way, had a LaSalle. Don't see LaSalles anymore. Had a LaSalle. Anyway, he drove up in this big Cadillac in front of his building, and he got out of the car and strode across the sidewalk. If I ever saw a soldier, I saw one then. And saluted the guards or something, went in the building, was all very fast, a matter of seconds. But anybody would know, even if he didn't know, that he'd seen a soldier. If he'd seen that. But we had a guy with us who was, when the parting of ways came, was sent over to the 8th Squadron. His name was Grant, and people called him Bitsy. I never knew much in those days and don't know much now, but it seems to me maybe Bitsy Grant was a famous golfer, tennis player, something, I don't know, something. Anyway, everybody called him Bitsy, and he was a somewhat of a wit, and he was funny. He happened to be in Brisbane at one time when General MacArthur was going to have a big ceremony of pinning medals on people, and Bitsy was due for a medal of some sort, and they rounded him up and put him in this lineup, or whatever you call it, and what he said later was, I'm sure, obviously it was a lie, but it was typical of Bitsy, and it was typical of the Air Corps' attitude towards General MacArthur in those days. We asked Bitsy what it was like, and he said, well, it was just a regular ceremony, no blah, blah, blah. And somebody said, Bitsy, did General MacArthur say anything to you? And he said, well, yes, he did. And said, what did he say? And he said, well, son, he said, are you a fighter pilot or are you a bomber pilot? And I said, I'm a fighter pilot, sir. And MacArthur said, well, I don't give a goddamn for bomber pilots, and that'll give you some idea of what I think of fighter pilots. I was still not on flying status at this time. But when the 7th Squadron first came over there and started flying from Dobradura, they were stationed at the end of the big strip, as we called it. And I've described the big strip already, I think. The big strip, the south end of the big strip, ended in just tall trees and a river. A steep bank down into the river and tall trees. The north end pointed towards the coastline and had a beautiful approaches, nothing but fields, open fields, there was high grass, there were no trees in the way. The east side of the strip was all trees, all jungle. But the west side was all a big field, open field, and in this field, located in this field, and running into the big strip like the long part of a T, letter T, was another strip, which again, in this case on the west side ended in jungle, but ended on the east side, right, but it ran into the big strip. And 7th Squadron was situated at the north end of the big strip. They didn't have anything there. There's a couple tents, and that's all. and it was an inconvenient place. But the fact was, they were preparing a brand new strip for us nearby, and it wasn't ready yet. So the 7th Squadron sat alert the north end of the big strip at this time. Now, I remember an incident that happened along about then. They were moving a B-25 squadron over to Dobadura from Port Moresby. And that meant that B-25s were coming in some numbers, loaded with nothing but baggage and personal belongings and personnel. They weren't on bombing missions. They were just ferrying airplanes and people and stuff. Now, for a long time, the B-25s had flown off the same strip as the P-40s and the P-39s, and they had long ago got it into their heads that they could do anything with a B-25 that we could do with a P-40. At least they certainly weren't averse to trying it. And this was one bright, sunshiny morning. And there came a B-25 over, which, as it turned out later, was heavily loaded, overloaded, no doubt, with people and baggage, and part of the moving process. Well, they wanted to do everything the way we did it, and this B-25 came over there, and I stood and watched it. And he buzzed the strip. He dove down at the end, flew right off the ground down the whole length of the strip, and pulled up in a big, tight 180-degree turn. And the idea would be that he would level off and put down his landing gear and come around and land on that strip. And I looked away, and when I looked back, instead of being leveled off and putting his gear down the way he was supposed to, he was clear over, almost on his back. Well, he came around the 180-degree left turn, diving turn, and trying to pull this airplane out of the dive, but he was too low for that. And I guess he got it pretty much leveled off before he hit the ground, but he hit the ground and just went down the length of the airstrip, disintegrating as he went. Fire flying off of everything, and finally there's a big whoomp and a lot of black smoke, and that's all there was left. It was a piece of nonsense, really, because there was no sense in that. You have accidents which can't well be helped, or second-guessers could have helped them and so on, but this was just foolishness. In my mind, I decided that probably the load shifted on him. He was probably full of people, which he was, I know that, but probably full of baggage. And when he made that tight pull-up and turn, some of that luggage and baggage shifted on him. And when he tried to straighten up, he couldn't. And there it was. There was nothing left. And I'll never forget the look of my crew chief. It wasn't my crew chief because I wasn't flying yet, but the crew chief of the airplane I was sitting on at the time, looking at me, and I looked at him, and he didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything. But I'm sure the same thoughts were going through our minds. I believe this is the right time to talk a little bit about what the life was like from day to day. As far as flying is concerned, I'll come to the rest later, but I already went into a little bit about the fact that if you were going to fly the next day, you knew that because it was on the blackboard in the mess hall. And it was laid out who was going to fly and what airplane. And so you would get up before dark, eat breakfast, and get in the Jeep with the other three people in your flight and drive or be driven down to the strip. And you'd go out and get your airplane and put your parachute in it and taxi it out to the strip. It had already been pre-flighted and warmed up, and you didn't give a thought to about whether it was full of gas or not, or whether it had plenty of oxygen or not, or whether plenty of oil or not, or plenty of coolant or not, or whether the water had been drained out of the gas tanks or any of that. You assume this had all been done, and it always had. You could count on that. I never saw it fail. You taxi down, you would park along the side of the strip. There would be 16 airplanes normally, and so 8 would be parked on one side and 8 on the other, right opposite one another. Then we had something that was called an alert hut, and now that depended. It might be a hut, and it might be a tent, and it might be absolutely nothing. But generally it was a thatched hut of some kind. Later on at Dobaduro, when we went to our own strip, we had I'll call it an elegant alert hut. It had a poured concrete floor. It was just like the mess hall, really. A tin roof of some kind. And a screen wire mesh from floor to ceiling. Floor to roof. And doors to keep the mosquitoes and insects out. It was divided into two parts. One part the maintenance people had, and they had all their tech manuals and maintenance books and records in there, and a place to lounge around. In our half, we had nothing but benches along the side and a few chairs of some sort. What sort of chairs? I really don't remember, but they wouldn't have amounted to much. They wouldn't be chairs in any formal sense. And there was a phone. The phone was connected to... Well, maybe there were two phones. There was a phone probably connected to any place you wanted around there, if you knew how to get it. They were what we called field phones. They were like those old phones that we used to have at Anoka, crank-type phones. You'd have to crank them to rouse anybody, and they were in a leather case hung on the wall on a nail. But then there was another phone, probably, which went to what we called fighter sector, which meant to the people who controlled the fighter planes and who were in touch with the radar people. So that if the radar people picked up a Japanese raid coming in, they could warn you. And you could do something about it. Now, we had two kinds of missions, mainly. We had scheduled missions. They might tell you in the beginning of the day, at 1 o'clock you're supposed to escort 50 C-47s up to Wau. Or at 8 o'clock you're going to escort 25 B-25s to Ley, or whatever these laid-on missions were. But the rest of the time, you just sat around on alert, as we called it, waiting for emergencies. That meant waiting to be raided. And these were called scrambles. The phone might ring, and the squadron commander pick it up, and they'd say scramble 16 or scramble 8 or whatever. Seldom less than 8, and that meant they had a radar plot of something coming in which they couldn't identify, and you were to get the hell off the ground as fast as you could. And we had all that down pretty well. People were on to that. And I mean, I think most of the time we could get 16 airplanes into the air in a minute. Now, that isn't quite true. I mean that in 6 seconds from they got the phone call, the first airplane would be airborne and the rest would follow at very short intervals thereafter. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. We could get the hell off the ground in no time. And people were motivated to do that in a hurry because it meant if you were late and there really was a raid coming on, you could get hit while you were on takeoff or just sitting ready for takeoff, which means you were at your most vulnerable, and nobody wanted that. So when they said go, we were pretty good on, by God, going on a normal takeoff.